supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to another amazing episode of You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Today's show is a special treat. Segments of my talk at Meadowbrook Farm in Abington, PA in July of this year. We got a dizzying diversity of topics to cover, so let's hop right in. Okay, so any questions about garlic, tomatoes, any other summertime crops? Yes.
Corn.
Sweet corn. Okay, so sweet corn, the days to maturity are true. So that is vitally important. This was a tough year for corn. Farmers who jumped the gun and planted corn during that freak warm stretch, which was technically way too soon, they're making out like bandits. Their corn is as high as an elephant's eye. People who waited, then it rained without stop for 2 months. You can't work wet soil. Certainly not if you're a professional farmer. Even treated seed is going to rot, and you destroy the soil structure if you work it when it's wet. So that's the corn you see in 90% of the places that's about this big. But from the time that plant breaks the surface, you look at that catalog description, and if it says 75 days, you want to mark that on your calendar. And 75 days after that, you want to go out and you want to start testing. The other rule is you mark the date on the calendar when the first silks appear. And 3 weeks after that is the earliest you can expect to have good corn. Now, sweet corn will often have a very short window. If you pick it too soon, it's not sweet. If you let it go too long, it'll actually be bitter. And then, you know, one of the nice things about sweet corn is if you miss the window, you can still let it dry and you can make cornmeal out of that. One of the most famous varieties of corn, I grew it when I was the editor of Organic Gardening. It's an heirloom called Bloody Butcher, because when it dries, the kernels are bright red and it looks like you cut off your thumb. It was Thomas Jefferson's favorite corn. The stalks are around 15 to 20 feet high. And if you pick it at exactly the right moment, it's a sweet corn. The kernels are white. It's only as they dry that they develop that red color of what we'll often call ornamental corn or Indian corn. But all of those corns, typically they're called flint corns or dent corns if you're growing them for saving. And again, this was a crop that would keep farmers alive over the winter. Because they wouldn't grow sweet corn. They would pick a little bit of their field corn at what's called the milk stage and eat it fresh, but most of that corn was saved because now you've got cornmeal, you've got mush, you know, you've got this nutritious food over the winter, and you've also got your seed for the following season. This was the era where it was sustainability or death. So corn is not a vegetable. Corn is a grain. Corn is a tall grass. Corn is the tallest grass that exists. So the rules for corn pollination are very different than vegetable pollination. I think a lot of us think that bees do a lot of work in the vegetable garden. Corn is wind pollinated. So it just depends on the wind carrying the pollen into the silks. Peppers are kind of self-pollinating. I've grown them indoors. And there's no difference between being outdoors and indoors. Squash of all kinds, whether it's summer squash or winter squash, requires pollination. And the best pollination is from a native bee who's actually called the squash bee. And if you grow a lot of squash, you've probably had the experience of being out in your garden in the morning when the squash blossoms open and there's a bee already inside. Well, he got drunk on pollen the night before and fell asleep in the barn. They are really industrious. They are the best pollinators in our environment. And you don't have to do anything to attract them other than to not use pesticides. If you don't use pesticides of any kind, including some organic ones, and you have the flowers that they like to pollinate, they will show up. You don't have to worry about it. You can attract things like mason bees, and you can protect things like digger bees and the cellophane bee. A cellophane bee is actually a female who makes little holes in the ground in bare earth and then deposits an egg inside this little nest. But before she does that, she wraps the inside of the nest with a form of plastic that she manufactures in her own body to keep it warm and dry and waterproof there. Wow. So it looks like it's lined with plastic, but it's actually a material like a spider's web. So what pollinates tomatoes? Anybody? Vibration. Yes. Now think about it. If you've grown squash, you've always seen bees on the squash. If you grow berries, whether they're blueberries, raspberries, blackberries, you always see bees on the flowers. You've never seen a bee on a tomato flower. The flowers are almost toxic to bees. You know, there's all this stuff about solanaceous crops and the family that includes tomatoes and potatoes and eggplant. And in truth, if you grow a potato wrong, there can be toxic parts if you expose the tubers underground to sunlight. Because you've all seen this when you bought a potato and it was green. That's because it was exposed to sunlight. You cut away the green part and it's perfectly safe to eat. But you don't eat the green part because it's toxic. Tomatoes are not toxic in any way, but there's something about the flowers that repels bees. However, if you're growing tomatoes indoors, which they do in Holland by the thousands of acres. If you've ever flown into the Netherlands, everybody talks about flying into the Netherlands in the spring and seeing the bulb fields, all these colorful blankets. When I flew into the Netherlands, all I saw was glass houses going on for miles and miles and miles. When you buy a ripe red bell pepper in the supermarket in the wintertime, that was grown in Holland. If you go to a wedding and there's an edible orchid on your dinner plate, that was grown in Holland. A third of the country is under glass. It's an area of the planet that should not have any horticultural industry, and instead it has half of it, because they're just determined. And if you go into one of their facilities where they're growing wintertime tomatoes, there will be bumblebee nests all around the ceiling of the greenhouse, because the bumblebees will fly around. They've got flowers there for them to feed them pollen. But just by passing near the tomato plant, they'll vibrate the pollen on a flower and move it around. And that's how you get tomatoes. Wow. Sometimes the wind is enough, but there's generally enough bumblebees. In your garden, if you live in this area, you probably have 35 different species of bumblebees. They may all look the same to you, but take a closer look. Some of them are black, some of them are striped, some of them have these gorgeous deep yellow golden jackets, almost fairy jackets. There's big ones, there's small ones, and they're all over the garden, and their vibrations are what turn a tomato flower into a tomato. Now, when you get to the end of the season, when your tomatoes start to turn red, if you're not saving the seed, if you really want to taste that tomato, you don't let it sit on the vine red. It drives me crazy, because I'll go around and I'll see these gardens that are bright red, and it's 90 degrees, and I'll think, oh my God, these tomatoes are being destroyed. If you have a tomato that achieves final ripeness, gets to its final color, is fully colored up, and you let it sit on the vine in the sun all day long, it can lose 30% of its flavor. And if you pick that tomato at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, it'll have 80% of the flavor of a tomato you pick at 8 a.m. Same is true of sweet corn. If you pick it during the heat of the day, it's going to have the least amount of sugars. If you pick it early in the morning, it's going to have the highest amount of sugars. As the sun goes down and the air cools, the sugars move from the roots of the plant up into the fruit. At the end of the cool period, right before the heat of the day begins, that's when the maximum amount of sugars are in the fruit or the sweet corn, whatever it is. Everything will taste better, whether it's a berry, whether it's a summer squash, whether it's sweet corn, tomatoes, even a pepper. It's going to taste better if it's harvested while it's cool and kept cool. For instance, with sweet corn, it drives me crazy, but you probably can't get good sweet corn in a farmer's market because it's sitting out in the sun. It makes me really mad, but you're going to get your best tasting sweet corn in a supermarket because they keep it refrigerated. When they pick the sweet corn, a professional will drive a truck, a refrigerated truck, up and down the rows. And as they pull the ears off, they throw it into the truck. Then it's taken by refrigerated truck to a supermarket where it's put into a refrigerator. And then, if you want to get the best sweet corn, they may have a big bin sitting out in the open, or they may have a smaller amount on one of these kind of underground air conditioners that's sending cold air up underneath. Don't strip the corn. Don't look at the edge of the ear. Feel them up. Find a nice full ear that seems about the right size that's the coldest of the bunch. Either have a cooler in your car if you're a madman like me, or take it home and put it in the fridge right away. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will travel down south to speak about the importance of horticultural therapy when I appear at a benefit for a very special healing garden on Tuesday, October 23rd at 5 o'clock at the beautiful Country Club of North Carolina in Pinehurst. But don't go checking the events section of our website for all the details just yet, because we'll be right back with more topics than you could fit in a glass house in Holland. I'm Mike McGrath, and you are listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Today's show is a special treat. Selected shorts from my talk at Meadowbrook Farm in Abington, PA in July of this year. In this segment, I'll discuss my love affair with garlic, heirloom tomatoes, and much more. Hey, let's dive right back in. This is the ultimate example of growing your own variety. 30 years ago, I was at a conference and was handed garlic from like five different growers, including Johnny's, and took it home, and I had all different varieties. And I planted them in the best draining beds in my garden. I love garlic for so many reasons. It is the crop I grow for myself. Everything else I grow for other people. But the garlic I grow for me. And one of the things I love about garlic is you grow it in the off season. You don't grow it in the summer when you're too busy with your tomatoes and your peppers and everything else. Garlic is like a cool season lawn. You establish it in the fall. A lot of seed catalogs will tell you you can plant garlic in the spring or the fall. That's a lie. Because, if they don't sell the garlic in the fall, they want to sell it to you in the spring. But the way garlic works, and look at how beautiful this is. This is so fresh. It just, literally, I picked it this morning out of my garden. Now, if I lived closer to here, and I had full sun, my garlic would have been ready in late June. I'm just beginning to harvest. Oh, baby doll. Oh, yeah. I'm going to pass this around. You can sniff my garlic. Oh, I'm serious. Here you go. Catch.
What kind of soil does garlic need?
The lightest, best draining soil you can possibly imagine. Fresh garlic, there's no connection to supermarket garlic. Most supermarket garlic now comes from China. The only place you can get locally grown garlic is at a farmer's market. So what you do, if you want to start, you buy your garlic ideally at a farmer's market. Almost anything but supermarket garlic. You can buy it from a catalog, that's fine. And when you go into a catalog, you're going to be offered two different kinds of garlic. Hardneck or softneck. So you want hardneck. Hardneck, this is the Sicilian garlic. This is the Italian garlic. This is the Russian garlic. This is the garlic of our grandparents. This is the garlic that immigrants brought over to put in their first gardens. Hardneck garlic likes cold winters. It is also the garlic that has all of the back flavors, all of the different tastes, all of the subtleties and arrogance together that you really want with garlic. Softneck garlic is otherwise known as white garlic, California garlic. It is the garlic that's grown in Gilroy and the other places in California that are known for garlic growing. It doesn't have as much flavor. It doesn't have the characteristics. It doesn't have the differences. It doesn't have the colors that hardneck garlic does. The purples that you get in the wrappers, the beautiful colors. The things that white garlic, softneck garlic, have growing for them is you can braid them. It would look like you could braid my garlic now, but you really can't. Once this dries, it's not going to make a good braid. But the softneck garlic is what you use to make these beautiful garlic wreaths and stuff like that, and it lasts longer. And you can grow softneck garlic in your garden. When you harvest it, again, right around this time of year, you want to cure it, no matter what kind of garlic you did. So, for instance, I bring mine in. I wait for a dry spell. I would never harvest when it was rainy or wet outside or after I had irrigated. You want to wait for a dry spell. You want to pull up a test plant, make sure there's a nice full head with a nice paper wrapper around it. And then ideally, hopefully, you have some sort of in-between space, like a porch or something like that. Mine happens to have a ceiling fan on it, so it's absolutely ideal. And I spread the garlic out on a table on this porch, and I run the ceiling fan. And it stays out there for about a week while I turn it. And then it's, quote, cured, which means it's not as, I guess, liquidy as this garlic is. This is really fresh. This is really pungent. You really want it to be a little bit more dry than this before you use it. But this is where you can really see the flavor of your harvest, the first taste of it. This kind of garlic, the hardneck garlic, it's going to start to sprout around Thanksgiving. So you got to use it fast. Softneck garlic, that'll hold for a year. You don't have to worry about that. But again, you're not going to get the flavors. You're not going to get the history. You're not going to get the backstory. It's like the difference between an early girl tomato and an heirloom tomato. Radiator Charlie's Mortgage Lifter, probably the biggest heirloom tomato you can grow. My Charlies are always between 3 and 4 pounds a piece.
Oh, wow.
Oh yeah, these are tomatoes the size of a child's head. And they have an incredible flavor, but they take about 100 days to produce that size of a ripe tomato. And that's 100 days from the day you put your plant that's 6 or 8 weeks old in the ground. That's not 100 days from seed. Days to maturity is a complete lie. You have to realize that days to maturity for sweet corn mean that number. Days to maturity for a tomato or a pepper mean you're starting with a 2-month-old plant. So you think about it, if you're a coward like me and you don't plant till June 1st, 90 days is all of June, all of July, all of August. I can't expect those tomatoes to come in until the kids are back in school. But they're going to be the last tomatoes to come in, and they're going to be the best tasting. They're also going to be the ones that if somebody is tomato deficient, all you have to do is give them one. Like, it's the ultimate bragging rights. So hardneck garlic is going to start sprouting. I do two things. First, as soon as it's cured, I start to tear these things apart. And I take the biggest cloves, and I do not use them. I go backwards. I save the biggest cloves for replanting. Because take a look at the size of those. Those are pretty good-sized cloves. That's the result of only using the biggest ones over and over again. And when you plant garlic, you take a head like this, you break it up into the individual cloves, and you plant each clove as if it was a seed, because that's truly what it is. Butt end down, pointy end up, about 6 inches underground, and about 6 inches apart. So garlic is so much fun. It grows in the wintertime when you're not using that garden space. But if you've never done it, I urge you to grow garlic. And again, by saving your biggest cloves and replanting those year after year, you create a new variety. And one of the things I'm proudest of is you can buy this garlic from Seed Savers Exchange. It's got my name on it. After I had grown it out in my garden for 30 years, they asked me for samples, and they started growing it out. And they put it out there as a variety that's good for cooler conditions and more shade. Although in the wintertime, I get full sun because the leaves on the trees are gone. Same thing for tomatoes. Kind of almost especially with tomatoes, because all of these heirloom varieties that people fall in love with the names of and the stories of, these are all tomatoes that were once carried in a seed catalog, either Gurney or Burpee or one of these turn-of-the-century companies. But over time, as hybrids became more popular, the line was dropped. But if you're a farmer, if you're living out kind of in the wilderness, if you're off the beaten path, you only buy a seed of one plant once. Because, you know, farmers, by definition, are the original seed savers. So somebody who grew the original pink Brandywine in 1896, they didn't buy fresh seed every year. Not unless there was a terrible disaster. They would just save the seed of the best tomato from the best plants and grow it out again year after year. So many varieties, hundreds of varieties that were thought to be completely lost were rediscovered in the 70s when it was the first real big back-to-the-land movement, when people wanted to get out of the city and homestead again. And a guy named Kent Wheely, who founded the Seed Savers Exchange, went to rural farms in Minnesota and Wisconsin and Nebraska and looked for unique tomatoes growing in the garden. And he would go there and he said, "What's this?" And they would go, "That's Grandmom's Fuzzy Peach." Or, "That's Abraham Lincoln." And that's the definition of an heirloom. It had to be available commercially at one point, was dropped from the catalog, and only exists today because home gardeners grew it out year after year after year. And sometimes it retained the name of the original catalog description, but sometimes the original name was lost and it became Aunt Eva's Purple Ball. But these are the best tomatoes. You have to think that it wasn't that easy, especially to save the seed of a tomato. It's not like saving pepper seed. You have to have a little bit of skill to do it correctly. But this was how people survived. You know, you couldn't afford to buy fresh seed year after year. Nobody grew hybrid sweet corn. They grew open pollinated sweet corn. And if it was a really good year, they would hold themselves back and let some of the corn get ruined, dry on the cob out in the field. And that's what they would use to plant again the next year. So you can only save the seed of open pollinated varieties. By definition, all heirlooms are open pollinated because they go back to the days before hybrids were really a popular technique. If you save the seed of a hybrid variety, and by law, any hybrid plant, the catalog description or the plant tag has to have the word hybrid after the variety name or the designation F1, which is simply a standard definition for the first marriage of the two plants that create the hybrid. You'll never see an F2. F2s and 3s are just for research only. And they tend to be the red-haired stepchild anyway. Nobody really wants them. And it just kind of tells the breeders what not to do again. So if it says hybrid or F1, you can enjoy it, and it's fine to grow hybrids. I grow hybrids in my garden. I've got room for all species out there. But you can't save the seeds. I mean, you can save the seeds. The seeds will be viable. But you save the seed of, say, a Whopper Improved from Park Seed, which is a beautiful, gorgeous beefsteak tomato, but it's a hybrid. You save the seed from a Whopper Improved and you grow it out. You have no idea what you're going to get. You could get a paste tomato. You could get a slicer. You could get a tomato that has a really vigorous plant and really crappy fruits. So there's no way you can duplicate a hybrid by yourself. You would need skills that are way beyond me. But if it's open pollinated, and you save mature seed, you're going to get exactly the same plant and exactly the same fruit. So if you want to save tomato seed, you can't just save the seed. Because think about what happens when you cut open a tomato. the seeds are in this gelatinous blob-like mass. So this is really nasty, but it's a skill you need if you're going to save your own tomato seed. You pick the plant that has the tomatoes you love the most. You pick the tomato that looks the most perfect, and then you let it sit out there and die the death of a dog. You let it get all wrinkly and awful and maybe a black spot on it. And then you bring it in, and you get a jar of water, and you get a spoon, and you scoop out the gelatinous stuff with the seeds inside. And you stir the water, and you let that jar sit out for 3 days, stirring it as often as you can. And it's going to look awful. But at the end of 3 days, you pour it through a strainer, and now the seeds don't have any of that gelatin on them, and the strainer is the perfect thing to place them in, because all of a sudden now they've got air on all sides. So you just flip them a little bit every once in a while. I'll actually take a little fan, like an office fan you put on your desk, and I'll have that blowing onto the bottom of the strainer to dry the seeds. You move them around with a chopstick or something like that that's not going to hurt them. And you go too far. You always make sure they're over dry. You never want to store seeds that still might have any kind of moistness. So ideally, you can actually take a seed and snap it. And then the seed is ready to store. And you're going to see all sorts of misinformation online about putting it in the fridge and everything like that. That's not what you want to do. You just want to get, again, something like a spice jar. And ideally, you'll get a couple of those little silica gel packets or balls that you get when you buy vitamins or running shoes. And you put a couple of those in there to make sure it absorbs the extra moisture. And then you want that seed to be cool and dry. Ideally, temperature and humidity adding up to less than 100. So that's not the fridge, which is totally humid, and perhaps maybe even a little too cool. The best thing is the coolest, driest room in your house. Certainly not the kitchen. Same thing as all the medical reports tell you, not in your bathroom. That's the worst place for your pills. That's the worst place for your seeds. And of course, that's where we keep all our pills. But you want to keep it in a room that does not see a lot of running water. Certainly not a room that has a shower or anything like that. And if you're like me, a room where you're going to find it in the spring, you know, and not find it in August and wonder, why did I put it there? So I store my seed in a bookcase in my office because there's no water near it. When I started growing, I would go to the Johnny's catalog, and Johnny's Selected Seeds, which was the place that all of the hippies bought their seeds in the 70s. And for a dollar, you could get a packet of 25 seeds. For a dollar and a quarter, you could get a quarter pound. So, you know, I would get this paste tomato called Bell Star, and I'd have 600 freaking seeds. What am I going to do with this? And I learned that if you stored them cool and dry, that this was like a 10-year supply. Up until 2004, that I was still growing seeds, I bought in 88. Wow. The USDA found all these abandoned extension offices that all had seed trays in them. And the seeds in the Northeast and the Mid-Atlantic were all ruined. None of them were still viable. But they got to Nevada, and seeds that were 60, 70, 80 years old still had like an 80% germination rate. So it really is that lack of humidity that really keeps those seeds going. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will be honored to deliver the keynote address Wednesday, October 17th at the Capitol Speakers Club in Washington, D.C., an organization founded over 65 years ago to empower women through the development of public speaking skills. It's at the Columbia Country Club in Chevy Chase, Maryland. I'll be joining past luminaries that have included Lady Bird Johnson and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Members only, but members may bring guests. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more topics than you could fit in a glass house in Holland. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and we are in the stretch now, cats and kittens. Today's show is a special treat. Segments of my talk at Meadowbrook Farm in Abington, PA in July of this year. In this portion, I'll pit rosemary against St. John's wort, and lemon-scented herbs will take on miserable mosquitoes. Let's dive back in and see who wins. All right, herbs. I see rosemary, okay? Sage will not make you sage. Sage has no mental properties whatsoever. It won't stave off dementia. It won't help you, you know, keep your brain power later in life. Rosemary will. Rosemary and my best source, gentleman just passed away, Dr. Jim Duke. He grew up in the mountains of West Virginia, so he's a good old boy. But he also worked for 35 years as a medicinal plant expert for the USDA in Washington. And he analyzed the compounds in all of these plants. By far, rosemary has the most phytochemicals that help stave off dementia and keep our brain power. It's also the plant of alertness. Some long-haul truck drivers have learned to keep a sprig of rosemary in their cab, or they'll actually have a little aromatherapy thing that'll spray rosemary into the cab if they're starting to get sleepy, but they have to drive another half an hour before they get to their stopping point. So rosemary is literally one of the most beneficial herbs you can grow. And it's frustrating because we're right on the cusp of reliable hardiness. Rosemary is a Mediterranean plant, like figs. Unlike figs, however, when rosemary dies over the winter, it dies forever. You can't kill a fig, but you can kill it enough that it'll never give you figs. Rosemary, I have tried over and over again, and the only way I've gotten it to overwinter is grow it in a pot and bring it inside. And it drives me crazy because I'll go down to Virginia, to like the Virginia Beach area, and even in city gardens, in community gardens like on South Street, there'll be rosemary plants that are a small tree, and nobody protects them over the winter, but in the heat sink of the city, you're a full USDA zone hire, and that's all that you need. But I don't think anybody in this climate can grow rosemary successfully outdoors and just leave it outside over the winter. But
I know somebody down the shore in Sea Isle. She has like this huge hedge of rosemary.
Because anytime you're near a large body of water, that's always going to kind of take the edge off the extremes. That's why when it was 96 degrees here, it was 84 degrees down in Wildwood. When, you know, it gets to be 10 degrees here, it's 30 degrees down the shore. Same thing if you grow on the shores of one of the Great Lakes or near a truly large body of water. But anytime you're near the ocean, it's always going to mitigate the extremes of your growing conditions.
This hedge is unbelievable.
You know, one of the natural aids in preventing dementia, I clearly don't grow enough myself, is rosemary. And I think sometimes people forget how much fun something like this is. Just to go out and play with it and get that smell. I mean, it really is good for you. St. John's wort is not the herb for depression. It's never had any effect on depression in controlled studies. Lemon balm is the single most effective herb. And lemon balm survives the winter beautifully in our climate. It doesn't take any skill at all to become a lemon balm farmer, you know, because it's in the mint family, and it will take over. So at the end of the season, when you're not supposed to prune anything, I go out and weed whack all of my lemon balm to the ground. So that way I only get 100 plants in the spring. Andy Weil, the natural medicine physician, Harvard trained, but a psychiatrist who never prescribed psychiatric drugs. He occasionally will feel blue, especially in the winter, seasonal defective disorder, SAD. And he pots up lemon balm and brings it inside to his house. And whenever he feels like a little down, he'll just go and rustle it up and get that smell. And it really is. It really is rejuvenating. This is lemon verbena. Now, this doesn't have that property, but this has another interesting property, as do all the lemon-scented herbs. Lemon thyme. Is that lemon thyme over there? Yeah. I see the trailing plant there. Is that lemon thyme?
Yep.
Okay. Well, up until a few years ago, because there have been some studies that have come up with some better ones. But for many years, this was the single best natural mosquito repellent. In studies that were done by the USDA, taking lemon thyme, crushing up the leaves and rubbing them on your skin was as effective as a medium level concentration of DEET. Further experiments showed that almost any lemon scented herb would work. Lemon thyme is the most effective, but as you can see, it's a small plant. It's a rock garden plant. It can be beautiful. This says it's variegated, but it's not as variegated as the ones I have at home, which have kind of a golden effect to them. Yeah, I see it there. It's just a young plant. But they never get really big. So it's hard to get the bulk unless, you know, if you really like this plant and if you really want to have a display in a rock garden, you don't buy one of these. You buy a flat and you put them in.
Does it last through the winter here? Yeah. Yes, it does if you give it good drainage.
Yes, exactly. Wet feet will kill almost any plant. But yes, I have lemon balm in half whiskey barrels. Most winters, they come back. But if we have a really cold, wet winter and that soil freezes hard for a long time and doesn't drain, it won't come back. But I'd call that a 50-50 plant.
Lots of grit and gravel in the soil. And as
Perlite.
Yeah, perlite.
Perlite. I love my perlite.
And lemon verbena.
Lemon verbena. All of the lemon-scented herbs are effective insect repellents. But there is no plant that will keep mosquitoes away sitting in a pot on your deck. I love, remember the ads? You don't see them much anymore for the famous mosquito-repelling plant. You would have this silhouette of a couple out on their deck, and there would be a plant in the middle of the table, and the mosquitoes would be like this. You know, oh God, I can't go near them. Well, that won't work. But if you bought that plant, it was a lemon-scented geranium. And if you crushed up the leaves and rubbed them on your skin, mosquitoes would not be able to bite you wherever you had rubbed the crushed leaves. It's like any insect repellent, whether you're using a natural one or something like DEET. You can't leave a spot on you uncovered, especially if they find you especially tasty. There are researchers now studying your sweat. People who get bit more often, they have them work out in these suits that retain their moisture, and then they're analyzing the sweat to see what's attractive about you that I don't give off. And they're hoping to come up with the next generation of mosquito repellents from that. Since those original studies were done where lemon thyme was the winner, and it's easy to understand why this plant was overlooked because it's Australian. Lemon eucalyptus. Imagine a eucalyptus that's lemon scented. But it's fairly common in Australia, and there was folklore there that it was a mosquito repellent. So it was tested, and now that is the only FDA approved natural mosquito repellent. It has shown to be effective in the worst test you can imagine. Is anybody here old enough to remember the old Off commercials on TV where somebody put their arm into the cage? That cage exists. It's down in the University of Florida. There's a researcher there who raises guaranteed disease-free mosquitoes. And he sorts out the females. And if you're a broke medical student, because there's a big medical college there, $50. $50 to put your arm in the cage. Now, they're going to smear something on you before you go in. But you don't know if it's DEET, lemon eucalyptus, something new. There's a substance called Bio-D that they're actually extracting from tomatoes. Or it could just be oil or water. So it's $50. And if you're not getting bitten, you have to stay in for 20 minutes. If you get like 20 bites right away, you get to come out. So, but that's the test that lemon eucalyptus passed. And then they tested it in the field. I forget what swampy marsh it was in, but it was like Chincoteague down on the eastern shore in Virginia. There's more mosquitoes than there's sand on the beach. And they tested it in the field, and it beat DEET. So there's a commercial brand called Repel, R-E-P-E-L, lemon eucalyptus, and you're not taking any half chances. It's not like you're settling or something. This is proven to be as effective as DEET. But DEET is incredibly toxic. If you use DEET or put it on your children, it says to reapply every 4 to 6 hours or whatever. And people used to think that, okay, well, it just off gases or goes into, no, it goes through you. It gets absorbed by your bloodstream, and it goes out through your kidneys and liver. You know, if you need a repellent, lemon eucalyptus is absolutely the way to go. And now we're seeing studies where catnip might be even better. So that is an active ingredient in a lot of herbal products. Now, it hasn't been, you know, when I say it hasn't been approved by the FDA, that doesn't mean it's not safe. To be actually approved by the FDA, it has to be safe and effective. So you're allowed to put catnip into an herbal remedy right now. But you have to use queasy wording. If you want to submit to FDA testing and it's shown to be effective, then it's on a different list. The things that are ruled to be safe, for instance, lemon thyme, lemon verbena, lemon balm, all those things, those are GRAS, generally regarded as safe. So they don't need to be submitted for human testing. They're not chemical products. They've been existing with our DNA for thousands of years. But you can't really make a medical claim unless you can prove it. We know from studies that rosemary does help prevent dementia. But catnip, things like that, they pose a problem to manufacturers. You can't own catnip. Spearmint, oh my God. Plant this once and you'll never have to plant it again. Now, one of the nice things about all these herbs. Yeah, sure. Compost. Use a lot of compost in your garden, right? Virtually any herb, because of the nature of the small flowers, will attract pollinators and beneficial insects. The easiest way to get pollinators into your garden is to literally buy twice as many herbs as you intend to use for other purposes, especially culinary. And the ones that you're going to use for culinary purposes prevent the flowers from forming. Don't let the flowers form. In most herbs, the flavor will go off after the plant begins to set seed. Basil is a classic example. And basil is the bad boy at the prom, because as soon as you plant it, it wants to go to seed the next day. So you got to be out there pinching your basil literally every day. But if you pinch it every day, the flavor stays perfect, and you get a much bigger, bushier plant. But the others, if you let those go to flower, then a couple of different things happen. Now we're talking about plants where you generally don't see the flowers, because that's the wrong way to do it. But now you see these delicate, beautiful little flowers. And don't be afraid to get out there with what I would call a magnifying glass, and somebody here might call a hand lens, and take a look at those flowers close up, because they're absolutely gorgeous. The closer you get to them, the more complex you can see, even in the smallest flower. There may be 100 different structures inside there. The smaller the flower, the easier it is for a beneficial insect to get in there and collect the pollen and energy that give it the energy it needs, the pollen and nectar, to go out and lay eggs in your pest caterpillars, to eat your aphids or your white flies or your sow bugs or anything like that for you. Well, that was so much information that we didn't have time to actually read the question of the week. But we have a great one for you. Detailed instructions on how to successfully overwinter pepper plants indoors, plus rosemary and other herbs that may not be winter hardy in your part of the country. As always, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden Question of the Week, and you will always find the latest question of the week at the Gardens Alive website. Yikes, my producer is threatening to make me stop talking if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call or email us anytime. You'll find all the details at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll also find the answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, and our podcast. Special thanks this week to Elizabeth Perez Luna for recording my conversation with the crowd that attended my talk at the fabulous Meadowbrook Farm in July of this year. Meadowbrook Farm, located in Abington, PA, is operated by the nonprofit Pennsylvania Horticultural Society, the group that stages the fabulous Philadelphia Flower Show every March, and whose proceeds go towards the creation of community gardens and other projects that keep alive the vision of Penn's Sylvan Woods. Not-so-Sylvan Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our vice president of production is Terry Murray. Elizabeth Perez Luna is also executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Our engineer is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work and stay current with what's happening with the show every day at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Larissa Sapko and Rich Banowitz are our website wonders. Affable Al Banks is our editor. Brazen Brett Rader is our producer. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Beginning next week, You Bet Your Garden will be coming to you from another public radio station. Now, if you listen in Dayton, Oklahoma City, Norfolk, Memphis, Nashville, Indiana Public Radio, or any of our other esteemed affiliate areas, nothing will change. Same with our podcast and our online stream. If you're a broadcast listener in the greater Philadelphia or South Jersey regions, please consult the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page or youbetyourgarden.org for your listening options. I'd like to take a moment and thank everyone who made the last two decades possible at WHYY, especially my first producer, Kingsley Smith, his esteemed follow-up, Mike and Scott, Gita Simons, Larry Roebling, Brett Rader, and my partner in crime for many years, Alexis Landis. But don't be confused. The door from Philadelphia may be closing, but another door is ready to open to bring you a brand new show, and me, next week. And now a final note, just to my fabulous Philadelphians. If we spirits have offended, think but this and all is mended, that you have but slumbered here, while these visions did appear. So give me your hands, if we be friends, and your good puck shall restore amends. Exit.